Absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much indeed. It's always so valuable, I think, to sort of pull back the curtains and see what's happening on the other side of the street, or in this case, the other side of the Atlantic. So thank you very much to Dennis. And we'll be taking questions at the end. So it's probably a good idea if there's something that you wanted to ask him about, and there was a lot of information there. Jot it down now, so when I come and ask you for questions, you'll remember. Our second presentation considers the impact of homelessness on children. As I said yesterday, government figures suggest there are currently around 3,000 families with children surviving in bed and breakfast accommodation in England, and about 100,000 children technically homeless in England. So what effect does this have on them, and how can we as a society help them to survive the trauma of homelessness? With an international perspective on this issue, please welcome the Professor of Child Psychiatry at the University of Leicester, Panos Vastanis. Panos, thank you.
Thank you very much, and particularly it's so impressive to see sort of Nigel's and the faculty attempts over the years and what you've achieved to see this network building and to hear all sort of diverse perspectives. I will try to contribute to different angles here. Okay, one is obvious, although it comes and goes, about children, families, and young people. And in relation to children, when we talk about the word homeless children, people get confused internationally. But essentially in the West, about victims of domestic violence. So the mechanisms are slightly different, but the issues are the same. And then the young people, adolescents, young adults, are those that you used to work with. And on the whole, I think the issues come much earlier. I work with looked after children. That's where at care living is sort of age where the most of the gaps are. So that's one element. That's 20 years of my life. I will compact in 5 slides. But what I'm more preoccupied about at the moment, it's the other side. It's not necessarily the international perspective. We have much better speakers on high-income countries. It is about the parallels in low-income countries, obviously at a different level, which is collective. What I would like to put to you, to the faculty, to Nigel, is that, well, those of you who work with homeless, we'll always be up against it. So I'm starting with something nice, really, because you have to be motivated. When you stand still, things move on, because they always come bottom of the pile. So you have to always to fight and advocate for them. And it usually gets very inspired people to do that. Having said that, it will never go away, another message of hope. So you might as well think of the parallels, the models, and I will show you why, what you have delivered, particularly in this country, but also in other models as well, how input can make disproportionate change in other parts of the world. So I better keep cracking on that, though. So again, broadening the Mark used the word trauma. Again, we're talking more about complex trauma, about a chain of events, and homelessness is one of several. I used to think it's the first. Far from it. Sometimes, at least for victims of domestic violence, it's a better break of worse sort of events. And we know a lot about, particularly about risk factors, less on resilience building and protective factors, which is becoming more of sort of the focus of interventions with the influx of refugees in Europe, the understanding that you cannot really intervene individually with children. This is only a small part. I'll show you a couple of sort of models. And that one needs to build layers around them. As far as interventions per se are concerned, for teenagers, young adults, again, it's the same principle. They have to be integrated. Not sort of good examples, but not huge evidence on like motivational interviewing, you know, the interventions you are trying with. And with parents, it's more, again, the attachment-focused, trauma-focused interventions. Really interesting emerging examples, but not the easiest to evaluate. Service gaps, where you know best, loads. So again, just looking at it visually, what sort of makes sense to you, but also it's backed by research, but also it gives you ideas of where to intervene, that whatever trauma is, okay, impacts on children directly, that's the relatively easiest to intervene if everything else is stable, but it rarely is, certainly never in your case. And then you have all the secondary impairments, social adversities, losing their networks, whether it's in the West or anywhere else. But that's the key here. These are the yellow arrows. The key are the caregivers. And, you know, we refer to mothers usually, but not only. And that's where sort of often the focus is not in interventions, because it's the parenting, the nurturing, the caregiving capacity that is the key. And that's the focus, for example, a family support service in Leicester, which just about, I think, survived loads of cuts and threats, just is focusing on. But again, for any child, looking at the whole world is important, but particularly for street children, homeless children, wherever they are in the world, that becomes more important because, as I said, these lines are fragmented. They're not strong. So if the family, there are no sort of networks, if you're particularly homeless mothers sort of moving around, preoccupied with their own distress, services are not there. Even school that is often a haven for other children, for example, victims of domestic violence, will flee and lose their own protective networks. So that's the key framework for emerging models, like I said, for refugee children, but for the groups we're working with. So it's how can we strengthen all these, not just one. This is an old slide, and I don't like using them, but it just made me reflect how things changed since then, and you don't expect the mechanism to change. You hope some of the service aspects do. Have they adapted? I think attitudes may have changed. This is an early study with homeless children in Birmingham, and as you can see, the majority had domestic violence, community neighborhood harassment. But the visual slide I showed earlier, it was textbook stuff. It was the history of mothers' own abusive histories that predicted their own mental health problems, and that predicted the children's mental health needs. The specific numbers don't matter because they're high anyway, and lots of developmental problems like delayed communication and report abuse is much higher because that was self-reported. And very limited contact with services, almost none for children. Has it changed? I hope you tell me something positive. I think it's gone up and down. I think other services, rather than mental health services in relation to children, may have filled some gaps, but I'm not terribly optimistic. I hope some attitudes have changed. I hope going into shelters these days and seeing children's names rather than numbers is a change in attitudes. Society is more child-centered. But I don't think, and as we heard before, I think the mechanisms that breed violence, community, domestic violence, and homelessness are those that one should intervene, as we just heard, and they seem to go up and down, and we're on a downward spiral. So finishing with at least some principles, which I think are exactly the same as they are with adults, that we're talking about integrated service, about care pathways, all the difficult issues that you've been fighting, that the faculty and Nigel and your colleagues have been fighting for years, that you need integrated health and social care for these groups, that they are not going to access services, they will go to A&E, they will go to child protection, specifically children with more extensive injuries. It's the same population that's in and out of the system, and care leavers will pop in and out of the judicial and system after they leave care at least sort of much higher rates than you'd expect. So the principles are not different. What is difficult is to sustain them. What we mean by direct access, to have child-friendly, engaging environments for adolescents and attitudes, that's much harder. And what I'm talking about, skills in applied therapies or interventions, it's about adapting. We have a plethora of interventions, which are much more fortunate these days, but they all sort of start from stable groups, which is fine up to a point, and then how we adapt them without losing fidelity, without losing the framework and the goals of the intervention, what differentiates them from just being support, which is good enough in its own right, but it's different. And also, how do we support the systems? Talking about ongoing training, consultation, but bringing systems together with, I don't want to use the word special service, I want to use more about the integration of existing health and social care services. And in times of crisis, it's well documented, and that's what's sort of happening now. Services tend to pull apart towards the core business, in inverted commas, and these groups are rarely part of the core business, unless people like you fight for them. So that was the West in how many minutes? I'm okay, I'm on time. I'll do the rest now. So how does our approach, I don't want to bore you with the logistics here because they were major, but essentially this wasn't a new question. It was always in the back of my mind, how does one intervene then? Can you intervene when or applying these models, what you've been doing for many years, to the world where we're talking about collective adversity, areas of ethnic displacement, war, particularly post-war or post-humanitarian disasters in slum areas and so on. And if there was a, at least I tried to approach it because this program were born, I mean, clinically and scientifically, it's the attachment theory has obviously had the most influence, anybody working in child trauma. But it was one of Mark's colleagues, journalists that I found more influential, called Sue Loy Roberts. And her motto was, sadly, she passed away last year from cancer, not in her field work. But her motto was, which I kept thinking about it, is that you need to, she always wanted to have a feel of the field, to be out there. And her motto was to young journalists, you cannot Google journalism, at least not all the time. So how to set up networks, as I said, moving around the logistics with partners. I had worked for many years. I had worked within Gaza and Iran in some strange places, but not in a service concept context. So this program was born by working with this network of trusted few. But what I asked them to do was to identify, I was quite interested in whatever the concept of homelessness is in the West. We're talking about street children and orphanages and slum areas, favelas. These are the big ones. And that's the overlap, because that's where they keep in and out, getting in and out. And I'll show you the narratives, although many of these areas, they have sort of research going on, like we just completed an intervention in Kenya. But I'll just stick to the narratives and some sort of aspects of what I thought was brilliant practice, but obviously overwhelming, and sort of an attempt to make sense of it in a wider sort of wider and more sustainable model, which is the main difficulty. So the program so far, I thought several times it might die. It hasn't died. It's got legs. It's in its third phase now, moving to the fourth. So the first one was essentially establishing networks, looking for sites that were able to at least get going, keep sort of small to medium-sized NGOs on the whole that had some networks in their communities, whatever the problems were. So just give you some observations in, you know, three of those in the first phase, and that was the beginning of last year. So again, in India, you can see these are both in Mumbai. That's in an urban near the slums. In the middle of the slums in eastern Mumbai. And this is in rural slums. Again, on the whole, different NGOs, on the whole run by religious or spiritual organizations. That's Ramakrishna Mission. That's the Catholic Church, which is very small there. And then you can see what's bad and what's potentially positive as well. That you can see what you see a lot in Eastern Europe here, all these children from the slums that they would go. So you can see they're lying in metal cots. And I don't think they were having a rest. I think they were completely unstimulated, like you see in institutions in Eastern Europe. And the staff were overwhelmed, but extremely caring and willing. And they used the word like psychology, and they wanted help. And of course, you can see it at a much, much larger scale. You've seen the film Railway Children. You can see in Mumbai, in particular, sort of rows and rows and rows of children, very young children in the evening, sort of setting their little, if you call it mattresses, a piece of cloth, by the railway, getting off to sleep. And Railway Children is a great charity based in the north of England. They've done fantastic work there. But also you can see some positive elements which I have found fairly consistent. They may not use the words we use here, which is integrated holistic care. So for example, in this rural area, not the young ones, but the teenagers, sort of boys, were going there for a year for carpentry and holistic sort of skills. And the girls were becoming healthcare assistants who were going back in the slums and working for the NGO, which I thought was a great model. They may have different outcomes than we have. Sometimes the outcome there is to get married, so the NGO might keep them until they get married. So that's something to consider for the faculty there. And that's in Kenya. I mean, large parts of Africa sort of torn by ethnic displacement. That was in 97, 98. And now things are much better. But of course, what follows, what I mentioned earlier about secondary impairment, what follows primary trauma, is extreme poverty. So these families have been ghettoed in very poor areas. I mean, this is a small, shed. That's their school with a teacher who's sort of part-time and paid by the grandparents. Most of the fathers were killed at the time. Young people, sort of the adolescents, roam the streets around. I mean, I would call them homeless personally, the street children. The little ones are looked after the grandmothers. Many of the mothers have died of HIV associated sort of illness. But again, what was positive there, that's the launch of a charity back in April. We were there 2 weeks ago. And again, I saw positive elements. People were initially puzzled when you asked them what they were doing, and then they became more confident. And some of the examples they gave was using peer counselors in the schools, and you believe it or not, the housing department had a helpline for children. So out of adversity came some great ideas. But of course, I don't know that they knew they were great ideas sometimes and connected them, and they started doing it at the time. And again, even the grandparents were, they asked for water, help with the school and counseling, again, believe it or not. So again, it was more sophisticated, people might expect, didn't ask for money, didn't ask even for food. And that's the second phase now of the charity. The third one is where one of the worst genocides happened, that's in Rwanda, where again, that was 20 years ago, 300,000 children were orphaned in 3 months. 1 million people were killed. And what followed, again, you can look that even sort of across generations, children, they opened orphanages. And now these children, young people like Oscar there, are in their early 20s. So there was a move internationally from the government. I think the West felt quite guilty. A lot of money went in to close at least those orphanages. And again, that's another sort of stage where you can have a rise in homelessness. If it doesn't work like closing asylums, which, you know, is a good thing, but if you don't compensate in the community, you can have rising homelessness there. And that's a very gratifying 3-day workshop there with carers. These are people, some of them were children in the orphanages and they're now become carers. This is a UK charity that's looking after the more disabled young people who could not be rehoused. So that's another risk there. But the carers sort of were able, again, to see their confidence grown in 3 days. The lady in red was a child in an orphanage, or others were carers in an orphanage themselves, extremely institutionalized. So to ask them about their role and, you know, seeing their confidence was just extraordinary. Mark, have I got 3 minutes or 1 minute? Just 3 slides. Okay, well, a bit more, but not that much more. Then I came back and Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that we need our basic needs met before we do, therapy or whatever with homeless people, which they may need, is not unknown. What I try to do working with partners like the World Psychiatric Association or ISPACAN, the international component of the NSPCC, was look at specific interventions. And again, there's no time to go through them. But obviously, safety is not just about legislation, it's about safe environments, about nurturing activities, working with the caregivers. A particular intervention we use is TheraPlay, again, based in the US, but used all over the world, which is not, it's not a specialist necessarily intervention, it's to give skills to the caregivers to shift attitudes in care homes where they're institutionalized. So that was my aim, not necessarily to do therapy. And then you have the resilience building approaches. There are some very good models, don't need to reinvent them, like the one we run in Kenya through schools. And again, counseling, psychological interventions have their place, but the rest is, I see it as a bonus. So ideally, that's the network. But again, it's a translation of what I've observed you doing over the years with adults in your services that influenced the thinking. And in reality there, the state is weak. Some cases it's corrupt. It's NGOs, you know, whether international or sort of locally run. and often supported by international partners like Hope and Homes, again another UK-based charity like Railway Children, who try to find families in Rwanda. And academic centers are probably better than I expected. I don't mean academically, that they can provide services, and we try to link them with NGOs to sustain skills. So I'll show you three case studies. Again, there are some data to go with them, but just some personal experiences. This is one of my favorite NGOs in Istanbul, the Hayat Foundation. So they cater for street children who they try to reunite with their families. And of course, they've had an influx of Syrian refugee children in recent years, 2 million in Turkey. Yes, more. Who again are sort of the new generation of homelessness all over the shop there that don't have camps. And this is a US charity that run creative activities. Some of them are intermixed with the children, who run sort of creative, trauma-focused, but sort of low-key universal interventions. This is a module on forgiveness they run, and they mix Syrian and Turkish children for the first time. I thought it wouldn't work, but it was okay. Three languages, no problem. They have very strong link with the university, with the volunteering program, ongoing volunteers who again need training, and that's another resource that gave me great ideas for other countries too. And this is the Turkish therapy person who is running nurturing techniques with caregivers and volunteers. So that was one example. The second one, Indonesia, was a different challenge because these are state orphanages or care homes. Now, these are all street children, even the babies. In my book, like Oscar, I saw you in Rwanda. Oscar was left in a plastic bag by the street, so have most of these babies, whether because, I don't know, they're illegitimate, for other reasons, abandoned, neglected, you name it. This is a state orphanage for younger children up to the age of 5. As you can see, the director is wearing a uniform, so it's a bit military, particularly the boys' ones. But fairly nurturing. I thought when women are directors, they're much more nurturing ethos. But also younger children. And again, I'm only giving the narrative that these children in the sort of classroom, they're about 4 to 5, so ready for the next step. Maybe a small example, but I thought they could take turns. They were very appropriate, socially interactive. So they had a great job in huge adversity there. And that's the boys' unit, which, as I said, a bit more regimental. And this is a drug rehabilitation center. I think that's a great example, which again comes from your field. These are all peer counselors. These boys were street children themselves. Then they were in street drug gangs. And somehow they managed to turn it around. They told me that the families were ashamed of them. I thought they should be really proud. Now they were actually trying to help others. Sometimes I thought they were a bit rough, but that comes with the territory. I think if you can smoothen the edges there, it was a great example. And they were quite stiff, but when I saw one of them taking a selfie of me, I thought we might as well take it properly, and it went wild. So they had great fun too. And that's the last one, was last month, it was in January in Pakistan, which again, the NGO, you can see how they diversify. They start from earthquakes, then had to respond to floods. But of course, there is safety. And that's interlinked with poverty. So that's a small school, great example in the middle of a slum. This is an orphanage for teenagers and younger girls. And that's a joint training that I will mention in a minute. I think the distinct characteristic there, again, you can see how the different types of trauma sort of one affect each other, is that you are aware of the large-scale violence in Pakistan. Only 2 weeks after that, there was another mass killing in a northwestern university. But the most worrying aspect was that many of these children are victims of what are called targeted killings, fathers' targeted killings. So because the mothers either cannot work or are not meant to work, or particularly in rural areas, they're put in orphanages. So there's been a huge rise in abandonment in such institutions. But again, some good examples that the NGO has been running programs for parents, for teachers, for many years, and it was the first time I saw it the other way around. The university that hosted our workshops when I left, invited the NGO to somehow borrow and share their training. So it's the other way around. The university led from the NGO. So that's how I've learned to ignore whoever is in the room in the last 2 years, whatever they look like. And I try to finish with this. And I think you can take what you want from it, whether it is we're talking about you know, the second part of the presentation and giving you ideas how people can learn from you in the most remote parts of the world, which we have the technology and the means these days, or whether I wanted to leave it for yourselves for the rest of the conference and the discussion. Thank you. Have done. Thank you.